Good evening. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Ed Bland. Can you all hear me? Well, that might be an unfortunate turn for you. I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana, and the way we say it is, I got good news and I got bad news. The good news first. I'm sober today. And whether you know it or not, you're very lucky. Because if I was drunk, I would try to mess up every one of your lives. I've got a home group, a sponsor. I've worked the steps with a number of sponsors a number of times. I've got a sobriety date. It's September 26, 1985. And I've got a higher power that believes in me. Now, none of that may impress you, but I want you to know it impresses the hell out of me. Now for the bad news. For you new folks, if you think you have a problem with drinking, the bad news is drinking is not your problem. Your problem is your thinking. And further bad news is, we're the help. So you new guys, take a good look around, and this is what you got coming. Anyway, I'm just tickled to death to be here. I get to see some very dear friends of mine. And congratulations, Annie. It's so good to see you. And Stephen, thanks for asking me to come down. Brian, love you. Matt, it's good to see you. Harry, of course, my great good friend, Harry the Hat. And Stretch back there. And, of course, Sean. I'm going to relay the story of deep, deep tragedy. From my way of thinking, it was very tragic, you know. The day before I turned 21, I had been drunk 5 times in my life. And I had been in jail 5 times in my life. Now, a normal person would have kind of got some kind of clue that there might have been a little something wrong. But like I like to say and think very often is that if I could drink like a normal person, I'd do it all the time. I was in the United States Army, and those folks must have been absolutely nuts, because they stationed me in San Francisco, and I was there in the 60s. And I found out that if you didn't like to smoke marijuana, you could always make a living selling it. And I made quite a good living selling it. And on one trip back, I was sitting on the plane. And when we got to San Francisco, these 4 really big guys stood up and looked at me. And I said, oh boy. And they pulled me off the plane. And as it turns out, being a very slick person, I managed to destroy the baggage claim ticket. So they couldn't get me with smuggling, but they did get me with Grand Theft Auto, and they sent me to prison. Now, in prison, I acquired the Raisin Jack and the Pruno concession and had 5-gallon buckets of Raisin Jack and Pruno hidden all over. And on a Friday night, I would pull it out and get half the prison drunk. And made a lot of money. And that went on until I was released. And after 2.5 years, the state of California let me go. And outside the gate, this parole officer said, Mr. Bland, the state of California wants you to leave. Now, you can go anywhere you want to go. No paper, with the provision that you don't ever come back. And that sounded like a pretty good deal to me, so they put me on a bus and I went to St. Louis, Missouri. I had a brother there and I stayed with him and I was there about 4 hours. And I decided I was going to take a look around and walked out the apartment door. And I don't mean to be crude, but as I was coming out the door, this redheaded lady walked by, and I looked her up and down, and as she was passing, I said, "Nice," and made a reference to her posterior. And she turned around and looked at me, and those green eyes, one went that way, and one went that way. And I said, "Let's go." And away we went. And for the next 4 months, she paid the freight. And we ended up in New Orleans. And there was a bar called the Abbey Bar. And in New Orleans, you can stay in a bar for 4 months and never leave. And when you do, you're liable to end up in a seedy motel. Now, I'm going to ask you guys a question. Be honest. How many have come to, after a four-month bin with a naked redheaded maniac waving a piece of paper and telling you that you got married? And when you say, "Oh, hell," she says, "You know what the best thing about being married is?" And you go, "Oh, no." And she goes, "Being pregnant." And if you're smart, you run like hell. And I did. And I ran and got me a job working offshore. And you go off for a week, you come back in for a week, and you do that, and it's generally a week of drunkenness, you know, and then you got to go back, and on and on. After about 6 or 7 months of that, I got to thinking, you know, all this work and stuff, and she was paying the freight, maybe I could go be a good husband. I mean, look, she was crazy enough to marry me to begin with. Obviously, she don't know what a good husband is. So I could probably get away with that. So I went there. And she had had the baby by then. And I didn't know anything about being a good husband or a good father. But I did know that her father said, "All you got to do is get a job and take care of her. And I'll help you all any way you can. I can." And I translated that to meaning free ride. But I did go get me a job as a bartender in a bowling alley / liquor store. And every night, when I would get off the bar, I'd be about half in the bag anyway, and I would slip through the liquor store, and I'd have a pint in here and a pint in here and a pint in the back pocket and a pint in the back pocket, and I'd head on home, and I'd walk down the railroad tracks, and I would pass this railroad station that they turned into a fur salon and a diamond or a jewelry store. And I was fascinated by that, and I would look at it, and then I would get angry because that represented everything I could not ever have or give this person, even though I didn't want to give her any of that. It just made me mad that I couldn't. And so I decided that I was going to burgle the joint. And not having any burglar experience didn't seem to hold me back. And so I looked it over for a couple of weeks. And one night I decided I'm going in. And I was drunk, bad drunk. And it was in the middle of January or December, whenever it was. And as I'm walking down the railroad tracks, I'm formulating my plan, and I'm drinking, and it's snowing like crazy. And by the time I get over there, I'm just going to go in. And I grabbed me one of them big old railroad rocks and threw it through the plate glass window. I ran across the tracks, hid under this bush, and waited for the cops to come. And they never showed up. So I said, now I'm going in. And I went over there and busted out the rest of that glass and got in there and grabbed me a handful of floor length mink and sable and, oh, yeah, fox and all this wonderful stuff, and breaking out the jewelry cases and stuffing my pockets full of stuff, and went out the window and across the railroad tracks and up the hill and down a little ways and in the backyard and right in the cellar. Dumped all the stuff and said, I'm going back. I don't know how many trips I made back and forth there, but as near as I can recall, I had damn near everything in the store, was now in the basement, and I passed plumb out. And I come to the next morning, and I see out the little basement window all kind of movement going on around. And being a curious kind of guy, I wondered what that was, and went upstairs and started out the back door, and there was a cop standing right there, and he had a gun on me. He says, get out of here. And I go out there, and they're all 10 or 20 of them laughing like hell. And I go, what are you guys? What's so funny? And they point, and there's a path cut through 2 foot of new snow from the window of that jewelry store right to that cellar door. And they put me in the car, and about 3 days later in jail, I finally figured out where I went wrong. And I decided that I should not do any more burglaring. And the redheaded maniac came after about a week and visited me, and she slipped up and said, is there anything I can do? Yeah, you can get your rich old man to bail me out of here. And he did. And I caught the first bus out of town and went back to New Orleans and started drinking and working offshore. 1 week, I told Brian I'd mention this. I'm sitting on the balcony of my apartment, which is on the slave quarter, in back of this big mansion, and there's a courtyard between me and the mansion. And I'm up there drinking, and I hear the gate open, and here comes the drunk. And he's rebounding off the wall, and I'm thinking, this is going to be fun. And it takes him about 35, 40 minutes to negotiate that flight of steps. And he gets right here, and he's walking by me. He gets down to the end of the building where his door is, and he's looking at the lock real serious. He's got his key out, and he's trying to get it in the lock, and it don't work, and he backs up a little bit. He lunges at it, and it don't work, and he backs up, and goes over the railing into the owner's brand-new BMW convertible. Crashes through the roof and is laying in the back seat. The owner comes out screaming, raising all kind of, the alarm's going off. He goes back in. Here come the cops. Cops pull the drunk out of the car, and they shaking him, saying, what the hell's going on? And he said, don't ask me. I just got here. And he was telling the truth. And it seems to me that for a long time, I would find myself in a jam and wonder, how did this happen? So I figured, since I wasn't really fit for polite company or being out in public, that I better go back offshore. So I did. And I kind of maintained for a little while. You'd go work on a week and then off a week. And after a while, I'd get off the helicopter, start out the gate, and there would be a bar, a motel, a bar, a bar, a grocery store, a bar, a motel. And I might make it past the first bar, but I might not. And I did that for about 4 years until I decided, well, the solution to that is just don't leave the rig. So I'd stay out for like 7, 8, 9, 10 months at a time until I just couldn't stand it anymore. I've been doing that for like 4 years. I came back to New Orleans. I went to the bank. There was like $78,000 in the bank, and I said, that'll do it. That will do it. So every morning, it was go to Schwagman, get the vodka, get the 12-pack of beer, go back to the house, drink, pass out, drink, pass out. So for you new guys, my life became that same old day after day after day of nothing but drinking, passing out, drinking, passing out, drinking, passing out. And of course you have to avoid the little pink-haired rats that try to get at you. But you can do that if you move into the walk-in closet and take up residence there, because no place else in the apartment is fit to live. Because there's paths cut through there. There's mountains of beer cans and empty vodka bottles and paper bags with one thing of crackers and a can of potted meat or a can of Vienna sausage, because one of these days I'm going to eat me a good square meal, you know, and it never seems to happen. And that went on for months, years, it seems like. And one evening, I'm just terrified. I'm panicking. I'm just going crazy. The little rat has found out how to get under the door, and he's got his head under there, and he's got these huge teeth, and he's clacking them, and he's laughing at me, and his big eyes are just going all over the place, and I'm backed up in the corner of the walk-in closet screaming my head off, and I come busting out of there and run out of the apartment and go down to the bar and sneak in the back door and sidle up to the bar, and I got, my hands are just gripping the bar, and I'm shaking, and I'm thinking, God, let tonight, please, God, let tonight be my turn. You know, when she brings the drink back, she's going to bring you a receipt. And if there's a red star on that receipt, you get a free drink. And my life has come down to getting a free drink. That's it. The hope, ambition, desire. One free drink, and it doesn't ever happen. And you stumble back to that apartment, pass out, and wake up. That was in early September 1985. I got to tell you, Schwagman's store had 15 giant supermarkets, Schwagman giant supermarkets, located all over New Orleans. I was banned from four of them because I had a bad habit of stealing a handful of swizzle sticks out of the bar, and you put them together and make one long one, and you put it down your shirt, and out through the bottom button of the shirt, and you go into Schwagman and you grab a cart, and you head for the liquor aisle and put your bottle of vodka right there and open it up and stick that straw down there, and this straw through here, and you push your cart up and down the aisle while you get toasted, and then you fall out in the frozen pizzas, and they come and they get you, and they take your picture and put it on a piece of paper and says, "Do not let this man in the store." But I had one store about 8 blocks from where I was living that I hadn't pulled any of my tricks on yet. And so I was going there, and you had to get there. I had to get there at 8:07 to get my liquor and beer and be okay for the day. And September in New Orleans, it is hot and it is humid. And if you're a drunk, you're sweating bullets and shaking, and your insides feel like they're made out of glass. They have sharp edges, and they're knocking and clicking together, and you feel like you're just coming unglued. And you've got to dodge traffic on top of all of that. It's not some place you want to spend a lot of time. You want to go get your stuff and get back. As I'm going to Schwagman, I'm starting to white out. You know, everything's just going white. And I'm sweating, and I don't know what's going on. I make it to Schwagman. I'm coming back, and I look on the neutral ground. He's huge, huge. You have oleanders. And there's a light breeze, and the leaves are rippling and stuff. You know, I said, "Oh, God, but it's cool under there. I'm going to go under there." So I go across the street and get on a neutral ground and get up under that bush, and it's about 20 degrees cooler in there. And I go, "Oh, this is a relief." And here comes that whiteout stuff again, and these faces are morphing on this white background, you know, and it's faces of everyone who's ever tried to help me. And when the white background disappeared, I had that bottle of vodka in my hand, and I was bawling like a baby. And I made the connection for the first time in my life that my life was going to hell because of that. But if you're a drunk, this is bad time, because if you don't have this, you know, there ain't much hope. You know, I don't know about anybody else, but drinking was never a problem for me. A lot of problem for the people around me, but for me, drinking was the solution. It was the solution. And I used it as a solution for everything. But now, with that moment of clarity, it wasn't any good anymore. But how in the hell are you going to just not drink? I said the only thing I knew to say was a prayer. "God, you either kill me or cure me." And I gave him about 4 minutes. I'm a rational guy. He didn't work no magic on me, and I decided, well, it must be up to me. And I, about that time, I noticed those cars on Broad are just flying by. But they have a break every once in a while. And I look, and down 2 blocks at Bienville, they got to stop for the light. And I see them coming. Well, the next time it happens, I start counting. And they hit right here at 12. And I watch him a couple of more cycles, and sure enough, 12, the car's right there. I say, "I'm going on 11. So I let a couple of more cycles come through, and sure enough, there's 12 right there. I'm going on 11. Here comes that cycle. They start off. I start counting. I hit 10 and a half. I'm going. I'm flying out of that bush. I'm flying through the air. I hit the pavement. What the hell, God? The car that's supposed to take me to heaven made a U-turn right there. And I'm thinking, boy, you must look like a real ass out here." Yeah, the insanity of an alcoholic when alcohol is at stake is a minute ago I'm worried about taking my life and not caring about nothing, and now all of a sudden I'm worried about looking like a fool. And I, you know, that stuff just doesn't jive, you know. So I made it back to the apartment, and I said, I got to do something. I don't know what to do. Maybe I do. Maybe I do. I'd been briefly in AA. And I called a man who happens to be my sponsor today. His name is Bill W., as a matter of fact. Got him on the phone. He said, what do you need, Ed? I said, I need to quit drinking. He says, you know what to do. And he hung up. Well, wait a minute here. As I remember it, you guys in AA are supposed to move heaven and earth to help the drunk. So I called him back. I said, you hung up on me. He says, yeah. I said, Bill, I told you I needed to quit drinking. He says, you know what to do. I said, wait a minute. He says, your old home group meets tonight. You ought to go down there. So I decided I would. And I went down there. And I got up to Charity Hospital. And I look across the courtyard. And this goofy redhead guy named Ambrose Hines, he's dead now, standing across the courtyard. And he happened to notice me. And he comes running across there. Gives me this big old bear hug and said, Ed, are you coming for the meeting? And I said, yes. And he's got a hold of me and he says, good. And he takes me upstairs. Go through the door and he says, hey guys, look who's here. Ed's back. And Skip was there and Reggie Gerstein, Phil Lewis, Lewis Lester, Little Nick, Gilda, Little Mick and his wife. And they all come over and grabbed a hold of me. Welcome. We're glad you're here. Except this one old guy named Skip walks up, looks me up and down. How you doing, Ed? And I was so happy to be there. I said, it's going good. And he said, from where I stand, it don't look nothing like good. But sit down. And he brought me a half a cup of coffee, half a cup, because I was pretty shaky. Now, in those days, if you voiced the desire to stop drinking, it was on. Those guys would jump on you like duck on a June bug. And they wouldn't let you go. I mean, they would not. Before that evening was over, I was surrounded by these eight or nine guys. Now, it has been an honor for me to tell newcomers the same thing that was told to me by these guys. And they couched them in the form of guarantees, and I'm going to give you new guys three guarantees. Three. Look, not only a guarantee, but three of them. Never been known to fail. Never been known to fail. And the first guarantee is, if you don't drink, you can't get drunk. Wow. I asked Skip, I said, how long have you known that? But it's true. I never thought of that. I never thought that. Never crossed my mind. He said, the second guarantee, we're going to send around a piece of paper with names and phone numbers on it. If you're serious about staying sober, you need help, you call one of us. We'll talk. We'll listen. We'll come get you. We'll take you to a meeting. We'll do whatever we can. But that's a guarantee. Okay. Third guarantee. If you're new, want to stay sober, tonight when you go home, get a piece of paper out. Write down on that paper what you want your life to be like 1 year from now. You don't drink, you get a sponsor, get those steps down, get through them, One year later, get that piece of paper out and look at it. You'll be amazed how much you shortchanged yourself. Absolutely amazed. And if you really want to mind screw yourself, go for 5 years and stay sober for 5 years, and you will just be completely amazed at how juvenile your thinking was. That's the way it was with me. Never been known to fail. I don't know how it works. I don't know why it works. All I know is that it works. All I know is that I've got a phone book. I have 760-odd phone numbers in that thing. I can call any one of those folks. Any one of them. And I know that my phone number is in at least that many phone books. And if they call me, that's a heavy burden, but it's the greatest joy I've ever known, is to be able to help somebody else. Skip became my sponsor, and we started through the steps. And I was finishing step four, and the last thing that went on my fourth step was, I hate Skip. I didn't put down what I really wanted to put down. I just figured a generic I hate Skip would suffice. And about 3 days after I did that, he died. And I bawled like a baby. I didn't know how much I loved that man. And I was as helpless and powerless, maybe even more so than when I first came in. Because now, I really felt. I don't know what I felt. I know that I felt alone. And those guys from the group surrounded me, and they surrounded others. And we all walked through together, and we all survived. One of my fondest memories, just to give you an idea of how these guys were, was Skip called me. It was like 8 o'clock in the morning. He says, 5 o'clock, your front porch, dress accordingly. Okay. 5 o'clock come. I got a coat on. I got a tie on. Here he comes. I go out. I get in the car. There's 6 or 7 other guys in the car. Away we go. I'm sober maybe 3 months at the time. I said, where are we going? He says, shut up. I shut up. We haul down the road. We end up in Greenville, Mississippi. Pull up in front of this funeral home. I go, uh-oh. Shut up. Away we go. Get inside. We're in the line. We get up. The widow is just boo-hooing, slinging snot all over the place. Skip walks up to her, introduces himself. She says, well, I don't believe I know you gentlemen. He says, we're from New Orleans. Well, how did you know my husband? Well, he came to AA meetings there. She said, oh, he wasn't that bad. And he looked over there and pointed at the guy laying in the box and said, honey, he's having a bad day. And we didn't make very much of an impression with her. And, at least he didn't. Me, I shut up, because, and, but he would have us doing things. Skip was sober, like 32 years, 34 years, something like that. And, had lunch with Bill W. a couple of times. He was an amazing character. And it's been, my wonderful joy to be surrounded by amazing, amazing people. And when you think about it, when I think about it, you take a person who's not fit to be seen in public, and then somehow something happens to where they become happy and content, satisfied with their life. Most importantly, they want to see others become that. And when one alcoholic looks at another alcoholic, especially the new guys coming in, they know exactly the reason why you cried at 2:30 in the morning and didn't know why. Because your life is just nuts. And you can't figure it out. These guys know. And they helped me to find out. It has been a tricky couple of last 6-7 years for me. The gal that I thought I was going to spend the rest of my life with didn't wake up one morning. My friend Harry, Brian, Stretch, Mick, a bunch of other guys come around me. And when I didn't know what the hell I was going to do, they just kind of walked it through me, walked through there with me, and somehow I didn't have to drink over that. And that's the way that it seems to work. Now, one of my sponsors put it very succinctly, said, someday you're going to be sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and somebody's going to say something that just rocks you. The only problem is that you got to be there to hear that. The problem, again, is you don't know where and you don't know when that's going to happen, but you got to be there. And the flip side of that is that someday you're going to be sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're going to say something that absolutely rocks somebody. But you got to be there to say it. It's an amazing gift that we're given that we can help someone. I was very curious and have been for many years about why there is such a thing as alcoholism. And I read this one book that the guy's kind of funny, but he says, see if you can understand this. His opening line is, he flung himself upon his horse and madly rode off in all directions. That is pretty much the mind of this alcoholic at times. And it takes somebody else who's riding that very same horse to understand. But some years ago, and I'm going to tell you that the only thing that I really know about this program is contained in this very short poem. I also have to tell you that I don't dabble in poetry. I don't like most of it because I don't understand it. But by God, I understand this. And this poem says, the wonderful love of a beautiful maid and the love of a staunch, true man, the love of a baby unafraid, has existed since life began. But the greatest love, the love of loves, even greater than that of a mother, is the tender, passionate, infinite love of one drunken bum for another. Thanks for listening.